You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Joseph Stiglitz's studies into the distribution of income and wealth go all the way back to the 1960s, and the Columbia University professor and Nobel laureate has written numerous books and hundreds of papers and essays on that and other key issues in economics over the past half century. Norton has just re-released two of his works on international economics in paperback with added chapters on recent developments, Globalization and Its Discontents Revisited, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump, now has a chapter on anti-globalization, and he has added a look at Britain's vote to leave the European Union to the euro, how a common currency threatens the future of Europe. I'm very pleased that Professor Stiglitz has joined us again on the show to discuss them and the shape of economic things to come.
Nice to be here.
You write that globalization in 2020 is different from globalization in 2000. What's changed over the past 20 years?
Well, when I wrote my book in the beginning of the century, I had written it after leaving the World Bank, where I'd been chief economist, and I had seen very visibly the way the globalization had worked to the disadvantage of many in the developing countries, particularly in Africa. I thought that globalization was unfair to developing countries. And then, of course, we move fast forward to 2016, and Trump is running on a campaign that globalization is unfair to the United States. And how could it be, I asked, that globalization, which was supposed to bring benefits to everybody, was becoming vilified by everybody, and both sides seemed to say that it was unfair to them.
How has the changing balance of power internationally, especially the growth of China and India, affected international economics and financial relations?
Oh, in a very fundamental way. In the period between the collapse of the Iron Curtain and, you might say, the fall of Lehman Brothers, we were dominant. The United States dominated globalization. We wrote the rules. And that is what makes it particularly ironic when Trump says it's been unfair to the United States. We wrote the rules, so how can we complain?
But did it all fall apart in 2008?
No. But there was a gradual process in which our relative role was diminishing. Trump has really marked a real big point where it's really dropped off the cliff, you might say. But the fundamental underlying economics was that China was growing much faster than the United States. So the share of the global economy that China represented was growing and our share was diminishing. And it was inevitable that we would move to a multipolar system. Trump has accelerated that movement.
I remember a time when it was thought that Japan was the country that was going to go past the United States. But wasn't the euro introduced at about the time that Globalization and Discontents was published? Did you imagine, or could you imagine anything like what's happening now?
Actually, I did, vis-a-vis the euro. When the euro was introduced, I was worried that the diversity in the countries was too great to make a single currency work.
As we've seen with Greece and Spain and some other countries.
Exactly. If you had created the institutions, the right institutions, it would have been a hard struggle, but you could have made it work. But the problem was they didn't create the institutions they needed. And in fact, what they did is actually created rules that made it perform more poorly than it needed to have done.
Wasn't there a backlash to the book at the time? Do you feel vindicated?
In many ways, I do feel vindicated for my on my book, Globalization and Its Discontents. When I wrote it, everybody said, oh, globalization, how could you criticize it? Isn't this the idea of globally integrated markets, the keystone of economics since Adam Smith and David Ricardo more than two centuries ago? Now, I think there's a widespread understanding that globalization has not worked for a majority of Americans and Europeans.
President Trump has said that the United States got a bad deal and that he can get a better one. What has he done to get a new deal of any kind?
Nothing. But the very idea that he put forward, that somehow our trade negotiators got snookered by these smart trade negotiators from Mexico or China, is laughable. I was in Africa last week and talking to one of the trade ministers, and he was just, you know, saying that it was absurd. The United States got almost everything it wanted. The problem was with what it wanted, and what it wanted was dictated by our corporations. And understanding that is key to understanding why globalization has turned out so badly for so many Americans.
Because you say that globalization really was not dictated by governments as much as by economic institutions?
Well, it was dictated by corporations. It was a corporate agenda. The way trade negotiations go on is the corporations are at the table. Civil society is not at the table, unions are not at the table, workers are not at the table. And so when they're at the table, they get to write the rules to reflect what they're interested in, which is their profits.
The president talked about this with Xi Jinping when he visited China. Did anything come out of that?
No. From China's point of view, it was a victory because he had threatened to impose 35% tariffs against China. And that itself was laughable because if he had done that, the disruption to the American economy, the disruption to the global economy would have been enormous. We would have violated international law. In a way, President Xi succeeded, I think, in pushing back enough that Trump did not do what he had threatened to do.
But he did withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership days after he took office, which has given China a lot of leverage.
It has opened up the space, but you have to understand the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was a badly crafted agreement. He was actually right, and that's the one thing I do agree with him. Even the U.S. government, when it looked at the TPP and said, what was the effect of TPP on U.S. economic growth, came to the conclusion that after 15 years, when it was fully implemented, the net effect on U.S. economic growth would be 0.15%. And other independent analysts said that was a gross exaggeration. So basically, TPP had very little to do with U.S. economic growth.
He's also criticized NAFTA and other trade agreements. Does NAFTA also deserve criticism?
Any agreement written 25 years ago needs to be rethought. And there are provisions in that agreement. There's a provision which is called an investment agreement, Chapter 11, that I've been very critical of. Interestingly, this is an example where Trump has again brought out some criticisms. The American corporations are up at arms. And so there's a real interesting political tension here. The Republican Party, supported by big corporations, is going to face a dilemma. Does it support the president who's criticizing this particular provision, which Elizabeth Warren has criticized, I've criticized, or will he side on the side of the corporations, which see this as an important weapon for weakening the bargaining power of workers and protecting corporations against regulations against, like the environment or labor?
My guest is Joseph Stiglitz, whose books, Globalization and Its Discontents, and The Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe, have been issued in revised editions by W.W. Norton. Didn't you grow up in Gary, Indiana, which had once been a major steel town? Did voters there share the grievances that many Trump supporters had?
Yes, and a few years ago, I went back to Gary, Indiana, to my 55th high school reunion, and it was an enlightening. It was before Trump had appeared on the scene, but I felt very strongly the discontent that they saw.
But they voted for Clinton, although the rural areas of Indiana all went for Trump.
That's right. And I think they understood, at least a lot of the voters understood, that Trump is not going to deliver on what he says. And if he did, it would make them even worse off. I mean, we see that right now in the tax bill. The tax bill is going to raise taxes on those whose income is under $75,000. You know, the steel workers
over the long run.
Over the long run, into the next decade. While it lowers taxes on the billionaires, it was a billionaire tax bill. So they understood that while Trump pretended to be on the side of workers, once he got in office, his true colors would become clear.
I've always wondered about the fact that after World War II, when the economy was really booming, taxation on the very rich was at its highest. I think it was up to something like 90%, although I doubt that anybody paid that much. But still, why is that not cited ever when we talk about actually lowering taxes for the wealthy?
Well, actually, I talk about that a lot, and I point out that there is very little evidence that lowering corporate income taxes across the board will generate growth and will not deliver higher incomes to workers.
You know, what's called trickle-down economics.
Trickle-down economics doesn't work. It's been shown not to work. And interestingly, Cohen, who is Trump's economic advisor, had a meeting with CEOs, and he asked them, how many of you are going to invest more if you got a tax cut? Three raised their hands, and he was a little bit embarrassed. They showed that, in fact, they verified what our economic analysis shown, that these tax cuts are not going to lead to more economic growth.
But as you said, it was not the U.S. and other governments that set the rules for globalization, but corporate and financial interests. So wouldn't administration officials like Betsy DeVos, Steve Mnuchin, Gary Cohn, and Wilbur Ross favor globalization, especially as it has developed over the past 20 years?
Well, some of these guys, like Wilbur Ross, were among those who took advantage of special provisions in the way globalization was managed to get more for themselves. So these are people who have who've taken advantages of the wrinkles in the system. When I say globalization is unfair, these are some of the people who have recognized the inequities in it and used globalization to win money for themselves at the expense of American workers and workers in other countries as well.
So as the corporations have grown over the last 30 or 40 years, the gains have gone to shareholders and executives rather than the workers?
That's pretty clear that the share of late workers has gone down. And globalization played an important role in that. That what globalization did is put America's workers, particularly unskilled workers, in competition with unskilled workers from China and other developing countries. And in that kind of competition, it weakened the bargaining power of workers. Companies could say, if you don't take a wage cut, we're going to move our factory abroad. So it's not a surprise that workers have not done very well.
I'm speaking with Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Columbia University, author of many books on economics. And we're talking about two reissues of previous works that have been updated considerably and released just recently by Norton in paperback. Globalization and its Discontents, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump is the way it's now being headed. And the other book is The Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe. And we will continue right after this. Mm-hmm. We're back with Joseph E. Stiglitz talking about two of his books that have been updated recently and re-released in paperback by Norton, The Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe, and Globalization and Its Discontents, Revisited, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump. How much have you added to each of these books?
A great deal to the book on globalization. What motivated that book was that when I wrote the first book, wrote the original version back in the beginning of the century, globalization was viewed as unfair to developing countries. And with Trump saying it was unfair to the United States, I wanted to know, how do you reconcile these two? How can it both be true?
And is it unfair to us at all?
Well, it's unfair to American workers. That's the point, that we, with the rules of the game being written by corporations, the consequences, even if the country as a whole has gained a little bit, not a lot, not as much as the advocates had claimed, and I try to explain why they oversold globalization, the fact is that at the same time it's caused a massive redistribution of income, with wages going down and corporate profits going up. So it's played a role, an important role, in the increasing inequality that has marked the last 15 years.
So your major argument against it is that it has been implemented wrong? Not
exactly.
That there is such a thing as globalization?
It's not inevitable. It wasn't inevitable. You could have managed globalization better. And that was really one of the main points of my original version. It was there I argued we could have managed globalization in ways that both the developed and the developing countries would have done well. And here the point is we could have managed globalization in such a way that workers would not have had to suffer to the extent that they have.
Was Brexit driven to some degree by anger of globalization?
Oh, very much so. It's very clear that if you look at the data, large groups of people in the UK have not done very well. And so the promises that were made that the EU would bring this enormous prosperity, just like the promises that were made that globalization would bring prosperity, were not true.
But haven't several of the claims of Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, and others in support of Brexit proven to be false?
Well, what was true is that their campaign was filled with what you might call lies or fake news, they didn't,
and they don't even have CNN, and yet they have fake news.
Exactly, and they didn't weren't honest about the difficulties that leaving the EU would present. They gave a sort of a picture that leaving the EU was going to give them a lot more money to spend for national health and for other purposes, and would not present any problems for trade. And now we've seen that those claims were wrong, that in fact they're negotiating the Brexit is extraordinarily difficult and presents a lot of risks for British firms.
Theresa May, her Conservative Party, and EU leaders have been unable to agree to a path to Brexit. What effect is that happening?
Well, what that means is there's a high level of uncertainty facing firms. So this is sort of the interesting picture. The exchange rate adjusted in the short run, which led to the UK economy doing reasonably well in the short run, the sort of picture of falling off the cliff that the Remainers said has not proven true. But the real risk associated with Brexit is for the long run, and this uncertainty has played into that long run difficulties that the UK is likely to face.
Is the European Union a kind of local globalization, and does it have all of the same problems that you're describing about international globalization?
Very much so. And in fact, when I wrote the EU, the book about the euro, I begin by saying one of the reasons American readers might be interested in the euro is that it is a small-scale experiment of much closer economic integration than we've tried at the global level. But because Europe didn't succeed in getting the rules of the game correct, what might have been a good experiment has turned into a very, very unsuccessful experiment. And so again, it's the issue of how you manage economic integration. They didn't manage it very well in Europe, and we're not doing a very good job here globally.
You write that Europe responded to the Brexit vote with the same harsh response it took to Greece's vote against EU bailout terms in 2015. Now, is the problem that the EU, in theory, is kind of like the United States, except that you have in this country, we have richer states and poorer states, but nothing like what's in Europe?
Yeah, there are two big differences. The magnitude of the differences in income are much larger in Europe. And at the same time, the powers of each of the nation states are much greater than the individual states within the United States. But it was very interesting in response to the departure of the UK. Europe's response was really to say, we will punish any country that leaves. We're going to be very harsh, rather than to say to the countries, look, we are offering you something that's really good. You should want to stay. And to me, it was sort of interesting that they took the punishment route rather than to say, we actually have here an economic system that's going to deliver benefits to all of you.
Despite its problems, Britain has more economic clout than Greece. Could it retaliate against EU pressure tactics?
Actually, there's still a big imbalance. The EU is so much larger than the UK that the balance of power is unambiguously on the EU side.
Is the US seeing problems more like Europe's as states and politics become more polarized throughout the country?
Well, I think we are seeing that kind of similarity that in the United States, we have this big red-blue divide. In Europe, the divide is north-south, in a way somewhat similar to the United States.
Perhaps the coastal states as opposed to the states in the middle.
That's right. And one aspect of that is very, very similar is that the Scandinavia, the northern states in Europe, believe in high taxes and strong welfare benefits, that there's a social contract, and that you ought to have expansionary fiscal policy when you have a downturn. And the conservative countries are trying to shrink the role of the state, and in many cases force countries to shrink the role of the state. So there's a kind of dictator relationship.
But aren't we seeing something similar here with the urban-rural divide, where the rural areas want to shrink the state? In fact, people like Steve Bannon say that's their goal.
That's right. But the irony of it is that the stakes, like in the South, that are trying to argue for a shrinking of the role of government are those states that are the net recipient of money from New York, from California, from the states that actually are functioning well. And this really goes to the point. Why are places that are doing well doing well? It's partly they have good infrastructure, good universities. We live in a knowledge economy, and that kind of knowledge requires technology, education, infrastructure, and those require a big role for government. The states that are not doing very well the governments haven't performed their basic role, and they're not functioning very well.
I'm speaking with Columbia University professor and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. We're talking about the reissue of two books that he's written in the past, but with heavy revisions. Globalization and Its Discontents, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump is the new title. And the other one, The Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Would the GOP tax plan have the effect of transferring more of the wealthier areas like New York City to poorer areas in states like Kansas?
Well, it is a tax plan that is perhaps the most vindictive that I've ever seen, where it actually targets the coastal states, which have high income taxes, limiting the provisions for state deductibility of state income taxes, for property taxes. So if you look at a map of who are the winners and the losers, it's the coastal states that are the losers, it's the Trump supporters that are the winners.
But the coastal states, you're saying, also are doing much of the funding of government.
Yeah, that's right. And including the governments in the states that are the Trump supporters. So it's a tax plan that is designed, rather than to bring us together, actually increase the divisions in our society. And, you know, just like over the last year, we've seen how Trump has exacerbated the divisions in our society. This tax plan is very much in that same mold. It's increasing the divisions in our society.
In the worldwide backlash against globalization, are countries becoming more isolationist, or is that just limited to Europe and North America?
It's mostly the United States and Europe that are becoming much more isolationist. In fact, President Xi has stepped forward and said he believes in a rules-based system of an international rule of law. So he's actually come out in favor of globalization. And this is really an important point that I raise in my book. Trump's solution to the problems of globalization is not going to work. He's trying to have the United States withdraw from the global system. You can't really do it, but the withdrawal of U.S. leadership is actually going to make the system not work as well as it otherwise would work, but it was also going to make our standards of living go down. So just like his tax plan is going to hurt the voters who supported him, his proposal for dealing with globalization is going to actually hurt the voters who supported him.
But they still stand by him, at least.
Is a little bit of a mystery. I think it's going to take a while. Some of the mechanisms by which protectionism, the style of Trump, are going to hurt are a little bit complex and are linked actually to the tax program. Let me try to explain that the trade deficit, which he's criticized, is basically a result of domestic macroeconomic policies in the United States. The trade deficit is going to be related to the difference between U.S. savings within our country and our investment. And the tax has the effect of decreasing U.S. savings. U.S. savings has three parts to it: private savings, household savings, corporate savings, and government savings. Larger deficits, and he's talking about $1.5 trillion or more, mean that savings go down and our trade deficit goes up. So the result of his policies, his tax policies, his macro policies, is going to mean that our trade deficit is going to go up. And no matter what he does in trade negotiations, and the result of that is going to be that those workers who've having a hard time, correctly so, you know, admittedly so, are going to have even a harder time.
But not all economists agree. Several conservative economists, including Robert Barrow, Michael Boskin, Glenn Hubbard, Douglas Holtz-Eakin, sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin arguing that the proposal would promote enough economic growth to offset revenue declines.
That's what's called dynamic scoring, and I would call it imaginary scoring. What they said is, if you look more carefully at what they said, is that there is some tax reform which, under some optimistic estimates, might work, not have as adverse effects on the trade deficit, on the fiscal deficit, as the critics responded. But we heard that once before. We heard that back in 1981 when Reagan said the tax cuts that he was proposing were going to pay for themselves. That was called supply-side economics at that time. And what we saw is they didn't pay for themselves. The deficit soared. It was really the beginning of the era of large deficits. After that, back in 1986, there had to be another tax reform after the 1981 tax reform.
But the economy is growing. Unemployment is below 5%. So aren't improvements for the average American on the horizon?
The GDP is growing, but still not as fast as it did when I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, when Clinton was the president. The fact is that growth by itself doesn't ensure that the average American is going to do well. The idea that growth leads all citizens to be better off is called trickle-down economics. We talked about that a little earlier. And trickle-down economics has been unambiguously refuted.
Is there some kind of link between populist politics and economics? Because you've talked about the threat of fascism. Do we really face with fascism here? The old slogan was, it can't happen here.
And it can. We should know there's no country that's really immune. When I wrote my book, The Price of Inequality, in 2012, what I said is I detailed the numbers about how growing inequality was a threat to the future of our economy and a threat to the future of our democratic politics. I actually was fairly explicit that growing inequality was opening up America to the possibility of a demagogue. I didn't think the demagogue would be Trump. I didn't think it would be somebody with his level of bigotry and misogyny. And, you know, I didn't think it would be that bad. But it was very clear to me at that time that this growing inequality was exposing us to a political risk.
What might economic stagnation for average Americans mean for political and social stability?
Well, clearly it poses the risk of things getting even worse than Trump. I mean, as we're going through Trump, you can say, could it get worse? The answer is yes, it could. And if we don't do something about this growing inequality, I think it's a risk that we have to be aware of, that we don't carry a special set of genes that protects us against extremes political extremes. And if you look at some of the politicians that are doing very well, look down in Alabama, and you understand that places in the country where growth is low and inequality is high, opportunity is low, stagnation is a part of their economy, those are places that seem to be particularly vulnerable to those kinds of politicians.
We've run out of time. I guess I have to invite you to come back because there's so much more to talk about.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
But I've enjoyed this conversation about the reissue of two of your books, heavily updated, the Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe, and also Globalization and Its Discontents, Revisited, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump, both published by Norton. Joseph Stiglitz is a professor of economics at Columbia and a Nobel laureate and a frequent guest on our show. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.